you already saw the title and Markus mentioned it, this joint work with Rudolf Alswiede, Igor Bielakowicz, and Holger Boche. And the paper is on the archive. We start with some notation. I mean, probably you all know these quantities, but I'm going to mention them anyway. So we have a sender, and he's got a pure entangled state on some composite system here. This F denotes the state space, and S wants to transmit one half of his state to the receiver R. He uses a channel N, which is completely positive, trace preserving, and has an input Hilbert space H and output Hilbert space K. Oh, well, bound operators on that, on these spaces, but these are the input spaces. Okay. S simply uses an encoding map P, which maps one of his systems to the input of the channel, and R then takes a recovery map and maps the output of the channel to a copy of F that's in his possession. And then they want to know whether they succeeded or not. They take this overlap here between the original state and the transformed version of it. And this is called the entanglement fidelity. And this rho here is simply the partial trace over the state psi that they were using. Mm-hmm. Okay, second, we need the coherent information. That's a measure of the noise that's induced by channel. And it's simply the difference of these two von Neumann entropies. So rho is any state, and psi is any purification of that state. Okay. And then, there's some additional notation here. We want to transmit maximal entangled states. Let's write them psi plus. Given the basis in F, you can write it like that. And I'm going to denote maximally mixed states, which arise as the partial traces over these maximal entangled states with pi F. And the F will always denote the subspace on which this pi is a maximally mixed state. Okay, now we come to the motivation, to the real scenario that we're going to deal with. So we are given a finite set of channels now. The whole thing also works with infinitely many channels, but you have to do a lot of approximation. So the basic ideas are already in this finite setting. No? So we don't need all this approximation stuff. So we are given this finite set of completely positive trace-preserving maps, and they all have the same input Hilbert space H and same output Hilbert space K. And for every M in the natural numbers, the sender controls these input Hilbert spaces, the receiver controls the outputs, and then we have a third party in the game. And this is called the adversary. This adversary chooses a sequence, SM, consisting of letters taken from this alphabet here, and then provides this product channel here. And S and R have to use this channel for transmission of entanglement. And the problem is that they don't know which choice the adversary is going to make. So they will try to find encoding and decoding schemes that work for every possible choice of this form here, of course. Here's a picture of the situation. So we have a sender over there somewhere, the receiver here, and the sender puts in one half of his state, which lives on H tensor 4, tensor H tensor 4, And the arbitrarily varying quantum channel consists of these three channels here. And yeah, that's simply, yeah, they don't know what's going to happen. Can be that they have to transmit over this channel, over that channel, this one here. When the index stays the same over the whole transmission, it's called a compound channel. Okay, we're going to need that later. So this is a special choice that's important. Okay, now we're going to deal with this whole situation in the asymptotic scenario, right? So we're going to let M go to infinity. Yeah, we need some definitions here. We're going to deal with random codes, and later we're going to try to de-randomize our codes so that they become deterministic. And such a code is given by number M and this KM here. And it's given by a probability measure on the set of input or yeah, encoding and recovery operations. And we also need some sigma algebra, but that's just a technicality. And yeah, we need that this sigma algebra contains the singleton sets because we want to talk about deterministic codes later. So point measures. The KM here is the input dimension. The dimension of the input space here. And yeah, then as usual, we say that, as usual in this quantum Shannon information theoretic scenario, we say that a non-negative number R is randomly achievable, or is a randomly achievable rate for this quantum channel. If we can come up with a sequence of these codes, such that the liminf 1 over m log km is lower bounded by r, and we also have here asymptotically perfect. So yeah, this is the maximum number that this entanglement fidelity can have. We want this on average over this probability measure mu m for every possible choice that the adversary might make. And yeah, we will only be having this perfect transmission in the limit of m going to infinity. And then, as usual, this random entanglement transmission capacity is defined to be the supremum over all achievable rates. So that's really the number that we are after here, this year. Okay, yeah, as I said, we are also going to consider deterministic codes, and here everything stays the same. I only say deterministic instead of random, and I add this additional requirement here that there is a certain encoding and recovery map such that the measure assigns value 1 to this pair and 0 to every other pair. And yeah, of course, I mean, this integral here is superfluous. I mean, this is a Dirac measure, so I wouldn't need the integral. But yeah, it's just to show you that everything stays the same. Instead of this, except this additional requirement there. Okay, now comes the main result. First, we define the convex hull of our set I, and then we can state this result here. So we are given a finite arbitrarily varying quantum channel, then its random coding capacity is given by this formula here, and you might recognize that. So if you think of I consisting of only one single channel, then of course the convex hull of this point is the point itself. And then you can remove this infimum here. And what's left is the usual formula for the capacity of stationary, memoryless quantum channel and for the transmission of entanglement over that thing. So that's, it looks familiar. And the second statement, and also the reason why it's called a dichotomy, is either this the corresponding random deterministic capacity is zero, or else it equals the random coding capacity. I'm actually slightly cheating here, because I could write here that the deterministic capacity for transmission of classical information is zero, or else the deterministic capacity for transmission of entanglement equals the random capacity for transmission of entanglement. Because if this thing here is greater than zero, then I can, of course, transmit classical information. And that's so this year, if this year is greater than zero, then I actually have more than if I can only transmit classical information. Yeah. That's really the main question that's left over now. I mean, we are.
So it could be that the data is always
sequential around. That could be, but we don't know. And that's really an annoying leftover. We just don't know. So. So here's an overview how this proof works. You can ignore the left part first. So at the basis, we have the standard coding theorem for memoryless quantum channels. And then we can use this to derive a coding theorem for quantum compound channels. This simply means that we're dealing with memoryless channels, but we don't know exactly which one. So you might think of a optical fiber, and it has a refraction index. Somehow this refraction index is important for your transmission. You know this optical fiber stays the same all the time, doesn't change. And the only thing is that the guy that produced the fiber said, the refraction index is 1.41 plus minus something. And then you have to have codes that deal with this plus minus something that work for every for every of these refraction indexes indices. That's the idea behind the compound channel. And once we have a coding theorem for this, we can use some classical techniques, which are mainly due to Alswedel, and then we get a coding theorem for the arbitrarily varying quantum channel. And as a second ingredient, we used Levy's lemma, basically, to show that the. I was talking about the transmission, the capacity for transmission of entanglement now, but you can also ask whether you can transmit every state taken from a subspace asymptotically perfect. So this I would call strong strong subspace transmission. Right. So classically, this is non-equivalent for arbitrarily varying quantum channels. So you can have the classical counterpart of strong subspace transmission would be maximal error probability, and for entanglement fidelity, the counterpart would be average error probability. And in the classical case, the two capacities are not equal. So that there are cases where they differ from each other. But here they are always the same. That's funny, really. We didn't expect that. Okay. Now,
So for compound channels, you cannot use an argument that just throw away half of the codes and get from the average.
Right.
You cannot use it.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about the converse. I will stick to this direct part. And Yeah, as I said, so I'm on the sort of the right part, you know, on the right path. So I assume I have these compound codes, and then I show you these techniques from Alsweder that lead to the coding theorem for the arbitrarily varying quantum channel. The first thing is this robustification technique. And yeah, you can write it like that. That's the first original version. We used another one, slightly better, which appeared, I don't know, 2 years later or so. So the relevant definitions are here at the lower end of the picture. So perm M is the set of permutations. Here, this T is the set of empirical distributions. And here's the definition of invariance. And what does this theorem say? If we have a function f, which is invariant under the action of the permutation group, going from the permutations, and this Sm into the interval between 0 and 1, and it satisfies this lower bound here for any permutation and every empirical distribution, then we can switch this average here from an average over these words to an average over the permutations and still maintain a good lower bound. Here's actually the first time that you see that it's important that we deal with finite arbitrarily varying channels, because otherwise, if this thing was infinite, yeah, we couldn't use this theorem. It's actually, in the classical case, it's very natural to have finite sets. If you have an infinite set, you can, since it's all about the convex hull, you can always approximate by a polyeder from the outside, and you stay within the set of channels because it's not round. But whereas in the quantum case, if you approximate this sphere from the outside with a polyeder, then you're outside of the set of quantum channels. So that's a little technical difficulty that took us quite a while to deal with. Okay, now suppose we know this result here. Then we know that we can have good codes for compound channels. So to every delta strictly larger than 0, k, natural number, and the row in the state space here, we can come up with a sequence of these mkm codes for the compound channel given by this set here, such that liminf 1 over m log km is lower bounded by this number here. And we have this additional inequality here. So for every channel in this convex hull, the entanglement fidelity of this maximum and mixed state, this recovery operation, and this product channel is lower bounded by 1 minus something exponential in m. And yeah, the c is some positive constant. So yeah, as I already said, this is a compound channel. It stays the same all the time, but you don't know exactly which one it is. It can be any out of this convex hull. And what we have to do now, in order to use Alsweder's theorem, is to define an appropriate function f. And we do so by making this definition. We are, for every m, we simply say f shall be given by this entanglement fidelity here. And the u's here are the usual permutations of tensor factors. So yeah, I only stated it here for k, but it is, of course, the same for h. And it can easily be checked that this thing is invariant under the action of the permutation group. We simply pick one permutation and apply Alsweder's theorem. Okay, so what's the lower bound that we get? You remember, we take this function, average over some distribution Q, then you want to have a good lower bound in order to switch to an average over permutations. And this can be done because the entanglement fidelity is linear in the channel. So if you have something like that, you can simply write all these Qs into the entanglement fidelity. Then you have this NQ tensor M here. And oops, this thing is an element of the convex hull of I by definition. And then from this compound channel result, we know that this lower bound here is valid. And then we know, okay, now we can switch from this average to this average. And this here is simply a random code, right? This is a random recovery, and this is this here is a random encoding. And again, you see the importance of the fact that the channel consists only of finitely many constituents. Okay, yeah, same statement that I just made. So we take this random code here. We know it achieves this number. Delta, K, and rho were arbitrary. And so we can as well take the maximum overall rho and here the limit of K going to infinity. And since we are talking about the supremum of all achievable rates, the delta doesn't matter. Okay. Now we have this random code, but what we really want is a deterministic code. The basic idea is to de-randomize, and yeah, the steps are stated here. So we assume that this thing is greater than zero. So yeah, we have a positive capacity for transmission of entanglement over this arbitrarily varying quantum channel. This implies that we can also transmit classical information. Okay, now we can simply send this classical information through the channel. Then we have common randomness between sender and receiver, and we can use this to so that they can use a random code, right? The only problem is that we have a very large random code, so we need to transmit very much common randomness. And yeah, there's a way out of this. We can simply use this elimination technique, which you find in this paper. And this is our quantum version. It's in principle, it's the same idea. So we start with this random code here. It doesn't matter what size the support of the thing is. And it is important that it's exponentially fast, actually. And then we can pick any epsilon between 0 and 1. And then we are sure that there exists an m such that for all m greater than this m, we get m square codes such that the average over them is lower bounded by 1 minus epsilon. And m square codes, that's really nothing. I mean, the amount of common randomness is really insignificant. This thing is still a random code here. I mean, but these guys here are the deterministic codes. Okay. Yeah. How much time did I use? It was quite fast. Um, Okay, now, there are two things now here. First, the first thing is symmetrizability, and yeah, the second thing is something about the maximal error. So maybe I just mentioned that there are conditions that tell us when the classical deterministic capacity is non-zero or not. And this is, well, it's an ugly formula. So first, it works for only for finite sets. I mean, okay, one could try some approximation stuff here, but I think we did. And since we thought that this might not be the thing, you know, that sort of remains, but it's rather just some statement, you know, we abandoned our approach to have this statement for infinitely large arbitrarily varying quantum channels as well. Because there's all this ugly approximation stuff that goes on there. Okay, so this definition here is the definition of symmetrizability. So you start with M symmetrizable or M symmetrizability. And yeah, this arbitrarily varying quantum channel is symmetrizable if for every finite set of states you have probability distributions such that for every pair taken out of the set, you can sort of, well, on average, fool the receiver. So now the receiver sort of has a measurement that detects the output of row J, and now the adversary can fool him, and his measurement will say, ah, it was row J. So it will frequently click when row J is sent. It will frequently click, but in fact it was row I that was sent. So that's the point here. And this has to hold for every M in the natural numbers. And then we say that this thing is symmetrizable. Okay, so it's again this unnerving regularization stuff. That's actually, yeah, a reason why I'm interested in conditions that tell us when the capacity is positive or not of a given channel. Because yeah, classically this is rather easy, but in the quantum case it seems to be difficult. Okay, so the corresponding theorem is that if this channel is symmetrizable according to that definition, then its classical deterministic capacity is zero, and the other way it works as well. Yeah, and the second statement follows from the first here. So if it is symmetrizable, so then this capacity is zero, and then this capacity has to be zero as well. Okay. Now we come to this left part of the of our proof. The equivalence of strong subspace transmission and entanglement transmission. So here, you see the statement that the capacity for transmission of entanglement over this arbitrarily varying quantum channel is lower bounded by R. And this second statement here is the transmission. The capacity for transmission of, for a strong transmission of subspaces, or no, for strong subspace transmission, is lower bounded by R. Okay. And yeah, the as I said, in the classical case, these two are non-equivalent. Whereas here, it doesn't matter. So So whether you achieve the one or the other goal, it's asymptotically the same. And we use this theorem. It's stated in Milman-Schechtmann, a book about this Banach space geometry, high-dimensional geometry, and it basically comes from Levi's lemma. Yeah, it's just a way to bound the values of nice behaving functions on subspaces. Maybe I do not read it. And that's the last slide.
Can you go back?
Sure. Sure. So here you have the entanglement fidelity, which is this overlap between the entangled psi with its transformed version, and here's the usual fidelity. And so this is the usual fidelity between a state, rho, which lives in the state space of this subspace Fm. And you want that this thing here is, well, yeah, asymptotically equal to one for every possible choice that you, for every possible density operator. Right. Yeah, you can basically take the same space. You start with that. Then there's a nice formula. I don't recall the exact thing, but it's something like that. You somehow have to put okay, so I should have put a U in here somewhere. And there. Now I need the unitary group on the subspace Fm, and here you have something like that. That's rather old. It's, I don't think, due to Werner and some other people. Yeah, then you simply take the function, okay. Then you use this function to, the concentration properties of this function. Oh, and sorry, I have to put the du here.
I still don't really understand why you couldn't use this so-called Gröning lemma. So classically, you know that if you compute the average error probability, you know by very simple argument, you can just throw away half of the code word and get a probability of error, which is, so if the average was, for example, greater or equal than 1 minus epsilon, you can get 1 minus 2 epsilon.
Yeah.
But I'm just throwing away half, so it's just one bit of thing that asymptotically is bit, doesn't count. But this also holds in exactly the same way also between entanglement fidelity and minimum entanglement fidelity. And I don't understand why you cannot use this argument here for
question. You would have to apply that for every n as n, right?
Yeah.
And then you would, I mean, every time you apply this thing, it would give you a different, I mean, you would probably get something like that, right? This all would start to depend on the SM, right?
Yeah.
And then you would end up with for every SM, you would have a different subspace, and you would have to deal with all these subspaces. And I think with classical sets, it might work, but these subspaces, they can lie in whatever directions, and you cannot put them together.
Maybe I'm starting seeing something, but yeah. Okay, thank
you. Okay. This was the last slide. No, the last slide is oh, sorry, that one.
So, any questions? Yeah, I'd like to thank you guys again.